In 1986, thoughts of breaking into computers for money were beginning to waft through the air. One Hamburg district attorney had developed a theory of how young hackers might unwittingly allow their computer expertise to be exploited for purposes of industrial espionage, or even by the East Bloc. Communist agents, he reasoned, already expert at manipulation, would have no trouble engaging the minds of wayward teenagers. Not only did nervous West German authorities and imaginative computer crime experts have their own finely crafted theories about the potential for exploiting impressionable young hackers, but the hackers themselves were beginning to see what was possible. Sometime in early 1986, the West German group decided to try in earnest to market its talents. Back in Dobbs' Hanover apartment, under the influence of many pipes of hash passed back and forth, Carl, Dobb, and Hagbard had a night of intense discussion. The first question, of course, was how to execute the initial contact. One idea was to go up to the door of the Soviet embassy in Bonn. Another idea, lifted perhaps from the pages of an espionage potboiler, was for one of them to slip a note written in code into his passport, a missive that would alert a border guard to his mission. It was a fine idea, all agreed, but no one was quite sure what the note should say. Peter Karl didn't have the technical talent of his colleagues, but he had made up for that with sheer bravado and a sense of the possible, so the intrepid Karl readily agreed to travel to East Berlin and do a little cold calling. The idea was simple enough. They were hackers who could get into some of the world's most sensitive computers. From those computers, they could extract sensitive information, information they knew would interest the Soviets. What was more, they could provide the Soviets with some of the software they needed to catch up with the technologically more advanced West. Why shouldn't the Soviets want to do business with them? Of course, it was illegal. They all knew that. But in selling the Russians military and scientific information, they argued, they would be doing their part for world peace. A name for the project? Equalizer. The idea was not to teach the Soviets how to hack themselves, but to keep them dependent upon the group somehow, to tell them just as much as they needed to know to stay interested, but not so much that they would be able to hack on their own. If the hackers were going to sell the access codes and hacking knowledge itself, then it would have to be a one-time deal and their price would have to be steep. 1,000,000 marks, they decided. For that, they would tell the Soviets about networks and throw in the list of logins and passwords for computer systems worldwide. The night wore on, and so did the hash. More hacking business ventures came to mind. Why restrict themselves to doing business with the Soviets? Why not include the Chinese? That idea was discarded when the group agreed that China wasn't enough of a player in the struggle between world powers. Project Equalizer had to stay focused. Hagbard and Dobb took on the job of putting together a demonstration package to show to their future business partners. Hagbard assembled a list of logins to computers, including those at SLAC in California, a computer at the Department of Energy, and the U.S. Defense Department's Optimus computer. Once Hagbard had opened a computer, he left it to Dobb to do research inside the computer, looking for material that might interest the Soviets. One document with the title Radioactive Fallouts in Area 9A and 9B sounded good. So did one called Propellants of ICBMs. Once he had downloaded the data, Dobb transferred it onto diskettes and made printouts of each file, being careful to delete any clues to passwords and break-in methods. All told, they gathered material from 30 different computers. In early September 1986, Peter Karl drove across East Germany from Hanover, left his car in West Berlin, and took the subway to the Soviet trade mission in East Berlin at Unter den Linden. He approached a guard who was seated behind a glass partition, introduced himself as Peter Karl from Hanover, and asked to speak to someone from the mission, as he had a business proposition to discuss. He assumed it was obvious that he was there to speak to someone from the KGB. The guard told him to take a seat. After 30 minutes' wait, a man appeared in the waiting area and asked Karl what he wanted to propose. Karl explained that he was a hacker from the West, with access to interesting information, and he wanted to propose a business deal. The man nodded and disappeared. 10 minutes later, a tall, dark-haired man emerged from the building's recesses. He introduced himself to Karl as Serge, the French pronunciation of the Russian name Sergei, and showed the visitor into a sparsely furnished conference room. Sergei asked Carl what he had in mind. Carl explained again that he was a member of a group that could get its hand on interesting information. Sergei was only vaguely familiar with the term hacker, and asked Carl to explain. Carl described most of what he knew. He said hackers were people who could break into computers and retrieve information and programs quickly and surreptitiously. Sergei still appeared to be confused, but his interest was piqued, and he asked for more specifics. This particular brand of hackers, Carl said, had the means to break into dozens of Western computers and get everything from information on high-energy physics research to proprietary banking data. Carl said he would like to offer the Soviets a package of West German hacking know-how, including logins and passwords to dozens of military computers in the United States. His price? 1,000,000 marks. More than $500,000. Sergei raised his eyebrows, but remained silent. Carl kept talking. He wanted very badly to appear to be someone worth 1,000,000 marks. He had a salesman's delivery and a salesman's confidence, even if the terms he tossed around were not quite accurate. He said he didn't have the demonstration package with him, that it was in West Berlin, ready for him to pick up and deliver to Sergei. He hadn't wanted to bring it with him on this first trip, as there was no telling who might search his bags. Sergei must have been amused and curious. If nothing else, the appearance of a computer hacker at the trade mission in East Berlin had no precedent. As a rule, when it came to gathering technology, the Soviets had a long tradition of doing their own fieldwork. Since most of what they were interested in, especially technology for advanced computing, was on a list of highly restricted technologies maintained by a consortium of Western nations known as COCOM, the Soviets had long since resorted to extra-legal means of procuring hardware and software. The FBI liked to maintain that Northern California's Silicon Valley, where much of American computer innovation resided, was crawling with KGB agents. The FBI claimed that one of the primary missions of the Soviet consulate in San Francisco was to funnel U.S. technology into the Soviet Union. The consulate building was suspected of having a hidden forest of antenna and other surveillance equipment on its roof, all targeted at capturing sensitive telephone calls in Silicon Valley. Through the years, a smattering of Soviet espionage cases had become public, but only because the spies were caught. The Soviets acquired advanced computers by hiring agents to set up dummy companies, order whatever was needed, and then fold quietly. For the most part, the Soviets had a long-standing practice of reverse engineering technology based on what they were able to gather. Of course, there was no way the Soviet Union was going to build a technological infrastructure by that method. Nevertheless, it was a system the Soviets continued to use partly because of trade restrictions, and partly from a simple predilection for doing things that way. All told, their software was a motley collection of retooled operating systems and compilers, roughly equivalent to the American originals, but transposed into Cyrillic. Their hardware was based principally on the VAX and older IBM 360 designs, and they were always on the lookout for good VAX software, especially VMS source code. Given the ease with which American computer networks can be entered from a safe redoubt outside the United States, it isn't hard to consider the possibility of a sophisticated Soviet intelligence-gathering operation targeting the vulnerable computers of commercial American high-technology ventures and non-classified U.S. military systems. In the early 1980s, officials in the Reagan administration expressed alarm at the existence of a circuitous computer link that would have allowed Soviets in Moscow to log directly into American computers. An out-of-the-way international research center located outside of Vienna and known as the International Institute for Advanced Statistical Analysis was connected by a commercial computer network to the United States and had a direct computer tie to a research center in Moscow. The Institute lost its U.S. funding as a result of the computer link. Some American officials argued that even though nothing secret was accessible from the center, it was conceivable that the Soviets could use the power inherent in computers to scan quickly through vast amounts of information and piece together a clearer picture of classified data. But there was no evidence to support this scenario, and several years later, U.S. funding for the Vienna Institute was quietly restored. Whether the Soviets truly had designs on young computer outlaws is unclear. That the Soviets would have called upon a select group of young experts to rummage around inside U.S. computers for them, or would have dispatched someone like Sergei on a recruiting spree to the chaos meetings in Hamburg, was probably a notion that existed only in the minds of nervous Western officials. But with this self-described hacker on his doorstep, promising tapes filled with digital delicacies from the West, it wasn't surprising that Sergei considered the idea worth pursuing. The Soviet official made it clear to his visitor that while he was by no means uninterested in what Carl was suggesting, he could hardly agree to hand over 1 million West German marks for something he not only hadn't seen, but didn't quite understand. And Carl himself, still struggling with some of the technical concepts with which his cohort seemed so comfortable, was in no position to deliver an extemporaneous lecture on the navigation of data communications networks, the computers that resided on those networks, or the specific information they contained. Like that of any marketing man, Carl's job wasn't so much to understand what he was trying to sell, but by virtue of his unerring enthusiasm to convey the value of his product. But even Sergei's most basic questions were too tough for him. Sergei asked Carl to return in the next few days with his demonstration package. It would be sent to Moscow for a thorough analysis, and, if it were deemed to be worth 1 million marks, then 1 million marks would be forthcoming. Sergei then asked to see Carl's passport. He took some notes and left the room briefly. When he returned, he told Carl that the next time he came, as long as he used the border crossings at Friedrichstrasse and Bornholmerstrasse, the guards would let him pass freely. 2 days later, Carl took Dobb's car and drove to the border at Bornholmerstrasse. After a brief glance at his passport, the guard waved him through. At the trade mission, he asked for Sergei. This time, Carl had with him the demonstration package, an index to computers around the U.S., with Pentagon computers at the top of the list. Under each heading was an index of what was contained in the individual computers. Account names and passwords had been carefully deleted. Sergei remained polite but skeptical. This time, Sergei gave Carl 300 marks for his expenses and made out a receipt. He also gave Carl a telephone number in East Berlin where Carl could reach him. He told Carl to learn the number by heart and to only call in an emergency. Carl used part of the money to fly back to Hanover. With the rest, he went straight out and bought a small Casio electronic notebook, where he entered Sergei's telephone number. When he spoke on the telephone to Hagbard or Dobb about his trip, he imparted his information in an appropriately cryptic manner. Paris meant East Berlin. Teddy Bear stood for Sergei, Russia, and the East Bloc. Equalizer, of course, was understood by all as the code name of the operation. A week later, on instructions from Sergei, Carl appeared at a building on Leipzigerstrasse, a main thoroughfare for traffic in and out of East Berlin. He took a rickety elevator to the 5th floor. From what Carl could observe, the office served as a business dealing in heavy machinery and railroads. Sergei greeted him, and this time they had a general conversation. Sergei wanted to know more about Carl's background. Carl could only assume that Sergei hadn't yet received word back from Moscow on the demonstration material. From then on, Sergei said, their meetings would take place at the Leipzigerstrasse location. At the next meeting the following week, Sergei told Carl that he had gotten a response from Moscow. While the package contained some interesting information and bore out Carl's claim that the group could get into certain interesting computers, it wasn't exactly what they were looking for. More to the point, 1 million marks for the demonstration package was out of the question. However, Sergei was interested in certain things that could bring the hackers some money. While he wasn't interested in general hacker know-how per se, he wanted to know if Carl's group could produce information about radar techniques, nuclear weapons, and the Strategic Defense Initiative. Moreover, he said, the source code for VMS and Unix, compiler programs and programs for computer-aided design and computer-aided manufacturing could bring the West Germans a tidy sum. Sergei said his customers back in Moscow also wanted software from the American firms Ashton Tate and Borland, two highly successful personal computer software companies. Such an exchange wasn't precisely what Carl had in mind. He had imagined that he would present Sergei with a menu of sorts, courtesy of Hagbard and Dobb, and that Sergei would tick off the various computers he was interested in. Then Carl would dispatch Hagbard to root out whatever he could. But Sergei appeared to have a different notion of what a hacker could provide. Not only was Carl not altogether certain he could get what Sergei needed, but he wasn't altogether certain what Sergei was talking about. Source code and compilers? These were things to consult with Dob about. It was beginning to look as if the things Carl had to offer, Sergey didn't want. And the things he wanted, Carl couldn't offer.
Nonetheless, Sergey remained sanguine about the prospects of what Carl and his friends might be able to supply.
This time, he gave Carl 600 marks, or $300, for his expenses, and took him out to eat. Over lunch, they made small talk. Carl learned that Sergey was married with children and that he liked to go fishing. But when Carl asked him to explain precisely what his job was, Sergey declined to answer. Sergey gave Carl photographs of a young woman and a small child, along with the woman's name, address, and telephone numbers. In the event that his frequent trips to East Berlin should prompt Western authorities to question him, Sergey said, Carl should tell them that he went to visit his girlfriend, with whom he had a daughter. Sergey seemed to keep at least two lists containing names of databases and software. It appeared to be a priority system of sorts, as the lists had a numbering scheme and items that were crossed out. By the fifth meeting or so, Sergey asked Carl to tell him something about the others in the group. Carl told him about Hagbard and Dob, while Sergey made notes in a black binder. And so the meetings went. Once every week or so through late 1986, always starting at noon, always consisting of a meal in a restaurant at which Sergey smoked Marlboros, drank glass after glass of orange juice, and at the end handed Carl 600 marks for his expenses. Even when Carl had nothing to deliver, he went anyway just for the 600 marks. Occasionally, Sergey gave Carl small presents, a nice cigarette lighter, a bottle of spirits, some Russian caviar. In spite of Sergey's measures for protecting Carl and his generally solicitous manner, the Soviets didn't appear to be particularly satisfied with what he was getting. Most of the material, he told Carl, consisted of indexes to information rather than the information itself, and that was often available only on microfiche. So Sergey brought his own computer expert to one of the meetings. But the expert could speak only English and Russian. He and Carl could barely communicate. Carl was frustrated. He didn't want the entire business going sour just because of a communications problem, so he asked Dob to accompany him on one of the trips to East Berlin. Carl told Dob that he would be able to clear things up because he would be able to understand exactly what Sergey was looking for. It took some persuading, but Dob finally agreed to go. During the meeting, Sergey explained once again that he was not going to buy the hacker know-how for 1,000,000 marks, and that he wasn't satisfied with the material that had been delivered so far. His interest, he emphasized, was information from U.S. military computers, source code, and compilers. Dob knew exactly what Sergey was saying, but the meeting was a disappointment. He didn't see that he would be able to get source code, nor could he get very excited about the idea of making a lot of small, low-paying deliveries over an extended period. Then Carl told Sergey about Pengo. He told him that Pengo was a particularly capable hacker, specializing in VAX computers, and that he could get good material. The Soviet expressed a great deal of interest in what Pengo might have to offer. He said he wanted to meet him in person and make his own assessment. Carl said he would bring him by.